House Committee on Revenue for April 4th, 2017 will come to order. Thank you, colleagues. We are going to go slightly out of order today, and we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2159. Chris, is that yours?
I am pitch hitting at the moment.
Okay.
So this bill deals with cider.
Oh.
That's about all I know.
Well, we could have Representative Leininger. Right. Representative Leininger's bill. She can explain
it to us.
Normally, staff would explain the bill, but it'll be your turn today.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. I'm here today to bring you a bill that is one of a suite of bills that the Committee on Small Business Growth developed during the interim, and as part of an effort of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade to find places where we can support economic growth for our businesses by streamlining regulations, aligning regulations, and removing red tape in a way that enables good businesses to expand market share. We all know, and I know Representative Johnson has done tremendous work to support Oregon's flourishing adult beverage sector, so beer, wine, spirits, cider, and
I don't know what that means, but
yeah, in the most respectful possible way.
Thank you, Representative.
It's an instance in which Oregon produces world-class products that begin with rural agriculture, involve value-added processing, and end in traded sector sales. That can be great for many diverse parts of our state. And so this bill is one that had a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Revenue, and it deals with cider. And I want to thank the Oregon Liquor Control Commission for helping identify this as a potential opportunity to align regulations and make things better for businesses. House Bill 2159 updates Oregon's definition of cider so that it matches the federal definition. Under current state law, cider must not contain more than 7% alcohol by volume. And this bill would increase that cap to 8.5%, which will provide a little bit more freedom and flexibility for Oregon producers to create a wider array of ciders. It also exempts cider producers from certain requirements, including cider makers right now hold OLCC winery licenses. And are accordingly required to possess certain federal permits that are specific to wine production. The requirements are burdensome and can be unnecessary. What this bill would do is essentially align Oregon's definitions more closely with the federal definitions to try to eliminate some levels of burden and make it easier for our cider makers to reduce transaction hassles and continue to grow their businesses. It is my hope that this is something that the sector will welcome, and Mr. Jesse Sweet, who's been a really helpful member of the OLCC in identifying steps that might be useful to industry, is also here if you have technical questions.
Great. Well, maybe he could come up. And
that's a good idea.
And in case we do.
That seems.
In fact, my question is probably, is it probably a technical question?
Yeah.
Do you have questions for Representative Leininger? Okay. So let me ask my technical question. I suspect that cider is made differently than wine, although I don't know that. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it's also a different, doesn't fit into the same category as beer. I don't know if those are technical questions that are within your purview or not, but if they are, I'd sure appreciate an answer.
Okay. Thank you.
If you state your name for the record first.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I'm with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The question was essentially, how is cider made and how is it different than beer and wine? As far as the mechanics of making cider, it is a fermented fruit juice, alcoholic beverage, and that way it's more similar to wine. What's more pertinent to this bill is the way that cider is legally defined and how it's taxed as a result. So under current state law, any cider that is less than 7% ABV is defined as cider but treated as a malt beverage for the purpose of tax rate. Above 7% ABV is defined legally as a wine and taxed as such. So what this bill proposes to do is move that 7% line to 8.5% in order to achieve consistency with revisions to federal law. Did that answer your question?
I think so. It occurs to me there's probably a couple other differences. The bill refers to, in Section 4, Subsection 4, issues having to do with bonds and various kinds of issues having to do with wine production. I'm well aware of the fact that wine often involves significant aging, and the inventory of a winery may be significant compared to their annual sales. I suspect that's not true of cider makers, because I suspect without knowing that cider is sold when it's newly made. Is that accurate?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I believe that is accurate. The language in subsection 4 that you're referring to has a very particular purpose. It was introduced into the winery statute some years ago in order to close a loophole in which some retailers were using a winery license to do their retail operation.
Gotcha.
As a means to get around certain financial assistance requirements. As a result, prior legislature added this permit requirement to close that loophole. An inadvertent byproduct of closing that loophole is we required cideries who actually hold a winery license to get a permit which the federal government does not give them. So this is a correction here in the current bill.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Barker, if I may, this bill came out of the Economic Development and Trade Committee with unanimous due pass support, as I recall. And again, the goal is to align the requirements in Oregon with modifications that have been made at a federal level, which I believe Congressman Blumenauer has had a lead role in undertaking in order to support nationally the development and expansion of the cider industry. So hopefully you will find favor in this bill and move it on to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. I'm very aware of the history of the development of the wine industry in Oregon, and I suspect most of the committee members are as well. And, of course, some of the key actions that took place were done by the OLCC at the request of the wine growers themselves, having to do with labeling and a variety of other issues that led to Oregon wines being accepted as internationally as a legitimate and appropriate wine region. So when you started your presentation by talking about promoting Oregon business, Oregon development of Oregon beverage industry, for example, I'm a very strong supporter of getting it right, because when you get it right, you get all kinds of other benefits. Just for one example, Oregon has been able to import clones from Pinot Noir, grape varietal, from France, which the Californians cannot get. Why not? Because California allows the use of regional names on wines that are not produced in the region, like Burgundy and the like.
Interesting.
Chenin Blanc. Which are both French regions, and Oregon does not allow that because Oregon has the proper labeling rules. So I'm right in there with you when it comes to figuring out ways to promote Oregon beverage industry in a way that protects public health and safety and at the same time promotes Oregon jobs. Representative Noakes?
No, I was just marveling at your wine snobbery. I had no idea you knew all this.
I'm good at it, aren't I? Yeah. But I don't often get an excuse to display it, so I thought this would be a good opportunity. And thank you for the editorial comment. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this bill impact or change at all a cidery's ability to host events or have activities on the premises? Does it change that at all? Does it make it more accessible or less accessible?
Finally, to a real question. Thank you.
Yeah, we've been sniffing the cork long enough.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, no, it does not.
Okay.
Please.
And then, if follow up on the taxation portion now. Would they be more in line with the beer tax and not the wine tax? Is that what we're – is that the operable change as well?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, they will be taxed at both the beer and the wine rate depending on the ABV of the finished product. So in that way, we're not changing the basic structure, but the bill does change the line at which the tax rate changes, which is a little bit convoluted.
Gotcha.
But it's kind of a hybrid product.
Wow.
It's taxed at both rates. It's maintaining that status, but it's just altering where we draw the line between the beer rate and the higher wine tax rate.
Yeah.
So, and I can add to that if that were.
So please. The line then is the 8.5. Is that the top end? Is that correct on the ABV?
Chair Barker, yeah. Representative Johnson, my understanding is that it would increase the cap to 8.5, so more product would fall below it than currently does, would fall within the beer rate. But any product above 8.5 would be continue to be taxed at a wine rate. Okay. It's just a higher ceiling before you get taxed at a wine rate to align with the federal approach.
Complicated for the producer, you know, to have to know each specific batch where you are. I guess if they're okay with it, I guess that's...
Why don't you treat that as a question?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Johnson. The producer will have to file potentially at two different rates, and that's what they have to do today. What this does is it makes us consistent with the federal filings, okay. So their state filings will be identical to the federal filings, and that's where we hope to see the increase in efficiency for the producers.
So it gets to your goal, which is simplification,
yeah. And
in a convoluted way.
Yeah. Over there.
Yeah. What's the difference in the tax rate?
Chair Barnhart.
Generally speaking, we don't need the details today.
The tax rate on malt beverages is $2.60 a barrel, which works out to approximately 8 cents a gallon. The tax rate for wine is either 65 cents a gallon for wines below 14% ABV, or 75 cents a gallon for wines above 14% ABV.
Okay, so this would have the effect of saving a little bit of money for the cider producers, because they would pay more of their product would be paid at the mm-hmm. beer rate, malt beverage rate.
Yeah, potentially, yes.
Right. Okay. Anything else? No one else has signed up for this bill. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this important frothy bill today? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2159. Thank you so much for bringing it to us today. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
And we'll go back to the top of the agenda and open the public hearing on House Bill 2939.
I'm intimidated by France.
Please. Yeah. They're still talking about wine. Please ignore them. Go ahead.
All right, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2939 it's a bill relating to making changes in a law that came about during the short session 2016 related to Senate Bill 1533. So what Senate Bill 1533 did is it did a number of things, but in relation to the changes contained in House Bill 2939, it allowed cities and counties to impose construction excise taxes upon improvements to residential, commercial, and industrial real properties. And it did the excise tax imposed on residential property was limited to no greater than 1% of the permit valuation of the residential construction permits. However, there was no limit placed in SB 1533 upon the construction excise tax imposed on the commercial and industrial improvements. So what House Bill 2939 would do is it would place, it would limit the city or the county that's imposing this construction excise tax on the improvements related to the commercial and industrial real property to no greater than 1% of the permit valuation. So it lines it up in some ways to what's on the residential side under current law. It does eliminate the authority of the city or the county to adjust the tax base to the commercial or industrial excise tax. the applicability is limited excise taxes imposed to the authority contained in Senate Bill 1533. So the new authority permitted in the 1533 bill passed in 2016, and those the construction excise taxes authority in that bill is what House Bill 2939 relates to, not any others that are on the books prior to that. Those remain unchanged. And it is the applicability of the limit that would be on the commercial industrial side in House Bill 2939 does go, it is on or the effective date of this measure and would apply to the excise taxes newly imposed under Senate Bill 1533. However, if a city or a county is imposing an excise tax above the limit that would be placed today, they can keep those funds, but going forward, they would be subject to that limit. So it could potentially bring a rate down if it's above the limit today. And then in the background of the SMS, I did include how the funds are dispersed as well from the excise taxes.
Okay. And that's the sub 2 of section 2, if I understand that right.
The retro...
Right.
Yes.
The last piece you were describing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, yeah. That's
okay. Yeah. All right. So... it does limit the tax to 1% after the effective date of the bill, even for those cities that have a higher rate now.
Yes, that is correct.
But they don't have to refund the tax they've already collected.
That's correct.
Gotcha.
And it is to the tax that is imposed from the new allowance under Senate Bill 1533. So if you had a construction tax from back in the 90s or something to that effect, that would be unrelated.
And the reason this is not an ORS reference is because it hasn't been added to ORS yet?
Right. This was just in the 2016 short session.
Okay. So. All right. Yes. All right. Thank you. We have several panels to hear on this bill today and several bills, so let's get to it. Kelly Ross, Eric Castle, Brent Hedberg, please.
That's a good point. Yeah, it does. Yeah, that does.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Ross, and I serve as executive director of the Oregon chapter of NAOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association. The bill before you deals with a situation that I think is the most vivid example of the old maxim, if you're not at the table, you're likely to be on the menu.
That definitely applies to the legislature.
Our industry wasn't involved in the discussions on Senate Bill 1533 last year, while we have been involved in government relations at the regional and local government level in the Portland metropolitan area. We haven't traditionally been involved with the legislature, and that dramatically changed after the passage of this bill, and we now have Mr. Hagedorn representing us here. But very briefly, I'll give a little policy overview of the bill. As committee staff explained, this deals with what we believe to be a very deep inconsistency in the law with the way commercial construction and development is treated elsewhere in Oregon law and at the metro level in Portland. Both the Metro Council and the Oregon Legislature, when they passed the construction excise tax for schools, recognized that there should be a cap on how much commercial development is expected to contribute towards the purposes of those taxes. I think it was a recognition that at some point the tax becomes disproportionate to the impact of commercial development on the goals that are trying to be achieved through the tax. So the bill started out last year in the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood, and amendments were adopted that imposed the 1% cap on both residential and commercial. When it was re-referred to the Senate Revenue and Finance Committee, amendments were adopted in the final days of the session that removed that cap for commercial. I've looked through the records of the committees involved in the floor deliberations and haven't been able to find any mention of why that happened. It just seemed to happen. So this is a bill represents an effort to deal with that situation, correct that inconsistency, to bring it in line with other construction excise taxes in the state. As the committee staff mentioned, that there's also a difference on how revenues from the commercial side are treated as opposed to the residential side. On the residential side, 100% of the construction excise tax revenues are dedicated to affordable housing programs. On the commercial side, only 50% are dedicated to affordable housing, and the rest is under the complete discretion of the local government. So it presents a fairly enticing target for revenue raising at the local government level. So with that, I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Castle and Mr. Hedberg to talk about kind of the real world impacts on their businesses.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee members. Thank you for having us down today for this hearing. My name is Eric Castle. I work with Shorenstein Realty Services. I am also the current board president of NAOP Oregon. Shorenstein Realty Services is a real estate investment company. We are owner, developers, managers, and leasers of office properties across the country. So to put into context, the last two developments that we did in Portland was the First and Main building, which is approximately $150 million development in downtown Portland. And we also developed a building in Cruz Way in Lake Oswego, which was approximately a $30 million development. So as developers, as you can imagine, kind of predictability and certainty of fees, whether that's for your own pro forma and also taking that to a lender is key. So the Senate Bill 1533 kind of puts that into doubt and gives a fair amount of uncertainty as those CET fees could be adjusted at any time, essentially. You know, a 50 basis point increase, for example, on the hypothetical development examples that we gave you could be up to $60,000 on that industrial building. So fairly significant increase in cost with a nominal increase in that tax. So I think the other thing that I would like to point out is that, you know, our region has grown a lot due to the fact that it's very affordable compared to other West Coast cities. You know, and that affordability could be in jeopardy as we come toward the end of a cycle. I think most economists and real estate experts are predicting that, you know, probably sometime in 2018, you know, this very robust cycle that we've been in is going to come to an end. And I think any increased fees, you know, could further erode our affordability in comparison to other markets. You know, and as developers and landlords, we don't observe these fees. These fees get passed on to tenants. So I think, you know, that can be problematic as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee members. Thank you for having us. My name is Brent Hedberg. I'm with Spec Development. We're a locally owned developer of commercial real estate, predominantly industrial, but pretty diverse portfolio of projects over the years. A little different than Eric, we've probably done projects that range from $500,000 all the way up to over $100 million, so pretty broad spectrum of things. I'm going to focus on a couple things. First one, Eric mentioned feasibility. You know, it may not seem like much, a 1% or 1.5% or 2% excise tax, but I view my job really as threading the needle between what the market rent is, what a contractor is going to charge us to build something, and what the cost of capital is. And we don't really have control over that cost of capital. Generally speaking, we're partnering with pension funds and life insurance companies to develop these projects. So, you know, if the cost goes for the excise tax goes from 1% to 2%, you know, that's a meaningful difference in the feasibility of a project, which may mean it doesn't go forward. The other piece of that is uncertainty. You know, these projects take a lot of time. So if we start a project and we're spending potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars on surveys and architects and planning fees and attorneys just to get something going, and 8 months into it, the fee doubles and makes that project unfeasible, or what we thought the fee would be or the excise tax would be doubles, then maybe you've spent all that money for naught. So I think uncertainty is something that developers hate more than anything else, and I think this bill helps give us some certainty as to what tax we should underwrite in deals. The only other thing I wanted to mention is just the trade-offs here. I understand the desire to raise revenue in this fashion, but as we look at the feasibility of a large project, an example that I'll use is a project we're currently working on in Gresham. It's a 732,000 square foot speculative industrial project, so about $65 million. So if this is it goes from a 1% fee or excise tax to a 2% excise tax, that's an additional $425,000 in cost, as compared to the property tax revenue from that project and the taxable increment, which is likely going to be that much money every year for as long as the project's there, increasing with its value. Those are the things I wanted to touch on. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for being here. So I really understand and relate to your comments about predictability. Of course, it is always the case when you're taking on a big project that cities have many kinds of fees. Construction have many other kinds of expenses to go to. Clearly, you know, your development fees could go up, but from the time that you begin assessing a project until the time you're ready to carry through with it, the price of steel could go up. So I'm wondering, have you seen a lot of volatility in excise taxes to bring on this particular concern with predictability of the level?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Marsh. A lot of jurisdictions haven't yet passed excise taxes as it relates to the bill that allowed them to do that. So no, but there's been differences between jurisdictions in what they're charging. So I think I heard it this morning that in Corvallis they're proposing a 1.5% excise tax, and other places are proposing a 1% tax. And so you go jurisdiction to jurisdiction. When is that going to pass? You're trying to guess at that.
May I ask a follow-up?
Please.
But is that not the case with all the kinds of things you encounter when you develop from one community to another? There are different fee structures of all kinds. There are different zoning requirements. I mean, you're assessing a project specifically to a community, it would seem to me.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair Barnhart, if I could respond to that, Representative Marsh. I think the difference between the construction excise tax and SDCs, for example, which are the other significant fee, is that under state law, as any changes to SDCs require a pretty significant analytical process, and so you have more advance notice of those being changed. The CET as a flat amount, can be changed very easily and very quickly. So you don't get that same kind of advance notice and ability to work in an analytical process to determine the impacts and relationship between the impacts that new development will have.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe not. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in how attractive or not the Portland Gresham area is to outside capital. I think you mentioned pension funds and whatnot are still apparently enthusiastic. Maybe they aren't. That's my question. Have the types of financial burdens that one encounters in areas like Portland reached a point where it's driving people away, or is it still a pretty attractive place?
Thank you, Representative Pence, Chair Bernhardt. It is still a pretty attractive place. I've lived here my whole life, and I certainly like it, and I think a lot of institutional capital sources feel the same way. But part of what drives that desire to locate capital here is the fact that it's more affordable than Seattle and San Francisco and other West Coast cities. And the farther you get away from that, I think the less attractive it becomes. So it's a place where you can come as a capital source and get a higher return because things are less expensive than Seattle or San Francisco.
Yeah, please.
So how much slack do we have? How much space is there? Because a 10% tax, would that still leave it attractive?
I wish I knew the answer to that.
If I may, not to be flippant about it, I just want to know how close we are to the breaking point, or is still a lot of space between us and Seattle?
I would say on the project that I mentioned in Gresham, right up until the point where we closed on the land and started construction, we weren't sure if it was going to go forward or not. At the end of the day, we were talking to one capital source out of a huge pool of capital sources that was still around, just because of the cost of the project relative to the rents.
Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to get back to your opening comments about what was it, being not invited to dinner or left off the menu. Or I just go back to the package of bills that we passed back in 2016, which are all about housing, affordable housing. And I'm frankly surprised to see that there's a provision in here for tax, you know, for raising taxes on commercial real estate. And then, of course, if there's only half of that, it's dedicated towards affordable housing. Is that correct? And the other half is just undedicated. So, again, I don't recall this, and I was someone who was pretty involved with the package of bills we passed in that session, and I'm kind of curious to why commercial real estate was even in there to begin with. So not really a question, just a comment, and I agree with your opening premise. Thank you.
Representative Vance?
Yeah, thank you. I want to return to that question about cost of capital again. The capital has been going – well, interest rates have been – trending up. That would, was that what was going on, and the reason you were having difficulty finding someone who was interested, because the, or am I incorrect in the upward trend in rates?
Thank you for the question. Yeah, I think it's a combination of construction costs and the cost of capital going up, and going up faster than the market rental rates. So in this case, this job was all union labor, so that adds cost. But at the same time, interest rates are going up, and the difference between, I guess, that risk premium for commercial real estate is compressing. So I'd say we're getting to a point where the cost of capital is going to start rising in conjunction with interest rates.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. When is this tax imposed? At what point do you have to pay it, or is it calculated? I don't see anything in the bill that directly refers to that, and maybe this is a question for Kyle rather than the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, I can answer
please.
That it's calculated at the time a building permit is applied for, and all the other fees are calculated at that same time and pegged. And is that your understanding?
Yeah, and I would add that the valuation of the project is determined largely by statute, that it dictates how the projects are to be valued for purposes of permit issuance, and then upon that that amount, there's a excise tax.
Okay, well, then that leads to a follow-up question. Is that valuation process fair and appropriate? May not be exactly accurate. I'd be astounded if they came in within a few hundred dollars on a really big project.
It's predictable.
But it's predictable. Thank you. That's really a better question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Better. Right. So then explain again why it is that – what it is about the possibility that the tax might at some point change leads to unpredictability. I think I can answer half of that question myself, but the other half I can't. I had – you know, the impression I got from the answer you originally gave was that somehow or another we'd be in the middle of the project and all of a sudden our taxes would go up. And, of course, I think what I just heard is that won't happen – because you already have a building permit by that time.
Go ahead. Okay.
Chair Barnhart, I think what the reference there would be is that you're in the planning phases of the project and you've pegged it at 1%, and then before you submit, it goes to 2%, and all your underwriting to your lender is based on the set of costs that then just change because the municipality increased the excise tax.
What's a reasonable period of time then for to lock in that rate before the building permit is issued? What kind of notice should the city give you before a rate goes up? An ordinance that says the rate's going to be 3.5%, it goes into effect on X date after the passage of the ordinance. What is X?
Mr. Chair, in dealing with local governments and when they're talking about increases to SDCs, our recommendation to them is to extend the effective date at least 9 months to a year to deal with all the projects that are in the current planning phase to deal with that.
Yeah, if I could go off that for a minute, I think I would say 9 months is short. I mean, there's projects where we've been working on them for 4 years. I know that somewhere in the middle there's a happy medium. But in a lot of cases, a project in particular in the city of Portland may take 12 months just to get through the entitlement process to get to the point where you have a permit, maybe to get to the point where you're even submitting for a permit.
Give me the number again.
It could take 12 months, at least on one project I'm working on, just to get to the point where you can submit for a building permit, where you have a land use approval, and now you're submitting for a building permit, and then there's another couple months beyond that. So if, you know, in the middle of we think we want to do this project to actually having a permit, that tax changes, you know, it really alters your underwriting and potentially upsets the feasibility of the project.
All right. Could your concern about predictability be dealt with by a notice requirement that similar to the one you have for SDCs, assuming it's long enough?
It could potentially be dealt with like that, but then you introduce inconsistency between residential projects. So now we're looking at, well, a residential project, we know what it is. On a commercial project, we've got to be a little more careful about it, watch the timeline. And
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. And Susan Stewart and Wade Lang. And Sean Miller, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name's Wade Lang. I'm Vice President, Regional Manager for American Assets Trust, and I should have brought those guys some cider because they said everything I was going to say. We are a developer and a owner and manager of real estate up and down the West Coast, primarily retail, commercial office, and residential. And we're here today in support of the bill and in support of the construction excise tax, but with a cap for the very same reasons you just heard, the certainty in development, to have those numbers in front of you and know what it is, and to echo what was just said, the time length from the beginning of a development project to the end is a very long time, and to have those numbers locked in and consistent throughout the development phase is critically important to the investors to know those numbers. So they said everything I was going to say. I won't keep your time. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And I appreciate your conservation of our time very much. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Susan Stewart. I'm the executive director of BOMA Oregon. And BOMA represents over 45 million square feet of commercial space. This is obviously very important to us. Last session, in the beginning, as it was mentioned, the bill 1533 had both residential and commercial. And I don't know what happened. I don't know if somehow the commercial sector, we dropped the ball, but somehow when the bill came out, commercial was gone, and we were all very surprised. Everything you said and they said, got to have a cap on this. There's too much uncertainty, especially with the economy potentially starting to dip in 2018. We need to make sure that our members know exactly what they're going to be, you know, hit with. The other thing, affordable housing, we were a little concerned that only 50% of the tax was going to affordable housing and the other 50% was going to the general fund. We certainly wouldn't oppose that, but I'm wondering if anyone can share the thinking on that with us. Okay, perfect. Okay, well, they've said everything we need to say. We are very supportive, and we hope you will be too.
Thank you. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Portland Business Alliance in support of House Bill 2939. As you heard from the prior panel, it does place the same cap on commercial construction excise tax that exists for the residential side. Commercial projects could be such at a large scale that even a 1% of the permit valuation could yield significant costs to the developers, as you've heard. We believe that a part of addressing the housing affordability is ensuring good jobs are available at income levels that can help individuals and families afford housing. We need jobs and housing, and this bill provides parity among those sectors without negatively impacting job growth. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Mr. Chair, I'll be brief, and that concludes my testimony, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you. Excuse me, just a moment. Representative Bence, please.
Yeah, forgive me, but...
No, go ahead.
Are you aware of any one of these that's higher than the 1% across your other experience?
Great question. Yeah.
I am not, but we'll ask the smart men in the back. I guess not.
I suspect the League of Cities and City of Portland will have some of that information as well, and we'll ask them.
Mr. Chair, I think you will hear from the City of Portland. They do have a plan for their residential and commercial excise tax.
Great. Thank you. Anything else? No. Thank you very much. And then we will call League of Cities, AOC, and the City of Portland. And while they're coming, is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? No hands go up. Okay. Good afternoon.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I want to go back a little bit in history because the construction excise tax doesn't just go back to last session. If some of you may be aware, we've had a construction excise tax in a lot of cities for decades. It wasn't until 2007 that there was a preemption that the legislature imposed. And at that time, they froze all cities where they were at with their construction excise tax and instead provided the option for school districts to impose a construction excise tax. But that tax was not a percentage. It was a per foot distinction. And what's interesting about that is it's also distinguished between residential and non-residential, but it's the flip. The residential was capped at $1 per square foot, and the non-residential was 50 cents per square foot. So what you have now is the opposite, that we have a cap on the residential for what goes back to the city and county and no cap on the commercial and industrial. And we think that that is an important distinction. But what was important about that bill in 2007 that provided it for school districts, there was this discussion about trying to give school districts an SDC, and that just didn't work. And so the trade-off that session was to give them this construction excise tax, and it's been optional. But the law at that point said, we're going to lift that preemption in January of 2018. So the counties and cities were supposed to get it back in 2018. So instead, because of the housing crisis, the deal last session was to give that construction excise tax back a year early. And so that's what you have. Why did we think about bringing it back early? Because it was working very well in one of the cities that had been grandfathered in, Bend. Bend had a fifth of a percent construction excise tax. And if it wasn't for that construction excise tax in Bend, they couldn't do the housing that they were able to do because it basically gets you cash. And that cash is what you need for an incentive to be able to pencil out these affordable housing, workforce housing units. And at that time, that community worked together with the builders and the chambers, et cetera, to impose a construction excise tax. So even before 2007, when we were preempted, cities had that authority. A few cities imposed it. There had never been a cap. A handful of cities and counties had this tax, but we self-regulated just fine. As I said, Bend had a fifth of a percent. During the recession, Bend even lowered their construction excise tax. So my main point is this. Each city and county has a different set of factual circumstances. Our mantra is home rule. The SDCs, the costs, every circumstance is different. The cities and counties should be trusted to handle that cap or handle the rate. We don't need a cap imposed by the state because it just doesn't make any sense. You have in OLIS letters from a few of our cities. Cannon Beach, the whole coast is struggling with this housing crisis. They've been having hearings since November on trying to decide whether they will impose a construction excise tax. It's a tool that might work for them. They're trying to figure it out. SDCs, as was talked about, are incredibly complicated for a small city to do. You have to do tons of studies and do all the economics, and it's just too costly, frankly, to impose an SDC. For some cities, it's simpler to do this construction excise tax, but they want to balance. They don't want to curb construction. We want our cities to grow and have economic development. So we're on the same page here of we know we can't raise it too much, but we have a housing crisis. And the housing crisis is for the people who work in these very commercial industrial buildings. So we have to work together on this. We would like your flexibility and would respectfully request that you not advance this bill because it very much was known that it was a cap on the residential. The theory was we have a housing crisis, so we don't want to put any more constraints on the residential. The taxes already for the school part was very low for the commercial industrial, so not having a cap made sense. We think this was the right balance. You haven't even allowed much time for this to work. It just passed in the 16 session, so we want to make sure we can even figure it out. And nobody has raised it more than 1%, save Corvallis. And Corvallis had a whole study and a work group to figure it out, and they realized if they only did 1%, they weren't going to get enough money to actually do the housing that city crucially needs. So they did vote for 1.5%, and this would undo that work. So for those reasons, we would ask you to not go forward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Let's do the rest of the panel, and then we'll have questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stacey Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties. I want to echo much of what my colleague from the cities has said, key points around this issue. It is new. We do have some counties that are currently in the process of considering the CET, and so I would encourage you to not go forward with this process. I think even though we've heard from the building community their need for certainty, you know, likewise our judges and commissioners need some certainty as they're considering potential construction excise taxes, what their options are as they're making the calculation about what those rates should be, how much money they're going to get, is it worth it for them. I would also echo the points made around self-regulation. You know, our folks don't want to inhibit development in their communities either. They're going to do due diligence to make sure that whatever rate they choose strikes that right balance. And, you know, really the overarching view of all of this is one of the primary tenets of AOC is that we believe our folks on the ground are best suited to make the decisions and respond to the issues in their local communities. Yeah. This has been a big, you know, win in terms of tool in the toolbox, and we would hate to see that rolled back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir. City of Portland.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. Also here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2939, though the City of Portland's construction excise tax, both on commercial and residential construction, is currently 1% and currently 100% dedicated to funding development and preservation of affordable housing at 60% or below area median income. That's the income of approximately, well, of two people both working full-time at minimum wage. We believe that communities need to have the flexibility to have discussions very similar to the one that we're having today in this committee about the merits of a local construction excise tax, and city councils and county commissions are very well equipped to consider the needs of their community as well as the potential impacts on construction activity and the overall state of the economy in their local area. So would encourage you not to move this bill forward. Do very much appreciate that the legislature restored this authority at the local level, and hope that we'll have the flexibility moving forward to consider calibration for different industry types, economic activity, and affordable housing demands. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Chair, would the City of Portland be okay if all of the proceeds from this excise tax be directed towards affordable housing, whether it's at 1% or something greater than that?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, as I stated, though, Portland's current construction excise tax on commercial construction is 100% dedicated for affordable housing. I think we very much appreciate that other communities may see nexus between other uses of the revenue raised that are just as important, and we think it's appropriate that that discretion be maintained at the local level.
Please, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Not to put words in your mouth, but you would appreciate some additional general fund revenue.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. So City of Portland's revenue is currently 100% dedicated for affordable housing. That's how the city has chosen to make use of that revenue that's raised, notwithstanding the flexibility or limitations that are currently in statute.
Okay. Representative Benz, did you have a question?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Portland have one of these taxes now?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence, yes, Portland has currently has a 1% construction excise tax, both on commercial and residential construction.
Yeah, the follow-up.
Please.
Is there any desire to increase it?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bence, I'm not aware of any desire to increase that amount. That amount was established last summer, approximately early last summer. But we believe that we should have the flexibility to make those considerations in the future.
Okay. All right. Can you give us an idea what the percentage of Portland residents fall below that 60% number that you were referring to for low-cost housing? Do you have an idea what that is?
Chair Barnhart, I'm not able to give you that number off the top of my head. Okay. I'd be happy to follow up.
I asked the proponents of the measure if we could increase predictability by adding a notice period. I don't know what the notice periods are now for city and county ordinances. I probably should know that, but I don't. And I'm wondering if they say that a reasonable notice period for an increase in a tax like this to establish predictability would be somewhere between 9 months and a year. Any idea what your jurisdictions would think about requiring that increases in this tax be noticed for 9 months or a year before going into effect?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not sure what those deadlines are. I know we have a notice requirement to have the actual public hearing to, and then subsequent meetings to actually impose it. And then I think you're talking more about the effective date.
Correct.
Should an ordinance be imposed? And to my knowledge, we don't have restrictions on those effective dates. I mean, I think last session's legislation was, the goal was to get working on this housing situation as quickly as possible, knowing that the construction excise tax wasn't going to be the silver bullet, because even imposing the tax means you have to get building going, and that takes time too. So it's just one tool of many, and so we wouldn't want to delay first imposition of these taxes by a year. That would sort of defeat the whole purpose of the 2016 bill. But going forward for an increase, perhaps that's something we could consider.
I'd like you to think about that as a possibility. The arguments that were made by the proponents, they didn't make at least only tangentially made the economic argument by saying that Oregon is a good place to come because it's less expensive than other places. But the argument they all consistently made was the decrease in predictability. If the city council at its whim at any moment could raise the tax and thereby throw into doubt the long established business plan for construction. And so what I'm really asking about is, could we deal with this in a different way other than establishing a limit to the amount of the tax? Could we do it in a different way by establishing a period during which this tax could be enacted but could not go into effect, allowing time for projects that were already in the planning stage to complete their budgets and get started before the increase? So I'd like you to think about that and get back to me about what that possibility is. I'm simply looking at an alternative to establishing a cap, that's all. And I can't tell you now what my own view is about either of those ideas.
Sure, Chair Barnhart, if I could respond quickly. Similar to LSE, we'd have to run that through our members, but our steering committee that deals with housing is actually meeting this coming Sunday, and so I can add that to our agenda as a topic for discussion and get back to you.
That might be useful. Thank you. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wendy, I'm hoping you can help me resurrect some of the history that you alluded to. I was not here a year ago, but my community was very much watching that unfolding housing discussion, which was started, I think, with a discussion of inclusive zoning and how to implement that across the state. A number of, as I understood the story, heard the story in my community, a number of changes were made to inclusive zoning as part of that process that made it fundamentally a tool that would be very difficult to apply in our smaller communities. So when we received the news of that and the package that was put together, it was our perception that the excise tax was really the only tool that came out of that discussion that would be useful to us in advancing our housing development. Is that a reasonable recollection?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, I'm not the housing lobbyist for the league, but I I definitely would have, you know, we're in constant contact and conversations about it. There was a package of four bills, and you're right, the number of houses that had to be or in the development that would even count for the exclusionary zoning just would not really work in most communities. They just don't have that size of development. So construction excise was one of the few tools that could be available to a community, of, no matter the size. And as I said, it's much easier to calculate and figure out the economics in a community for the construction excise tax. It is done at the permit stage. It just doesn't have the complications of figuring out for the water SDC or the sewer or the other SDCs. And so, yes, this was the one that would work for all communities. And I think that's an important point to make out that, yes, the metro areas had been particularly hit by the housing shortage and crisis, but we have a housing crisis in Central Oregon. We have one on the coast, and so we needed a tool that worked in all parts of the state, and this was one of those that would help by just lifting the preemption that was set to be lifted anyway soon. I mean, for us, we would have preferred lifting the preemption without any restrictions on how we use the money, but given the factual situation of the housing crisis, there was that nexus that the communities that need this revenue the most are the ones that are growing, and so this it made sense to give into those restrictions on the tax for now. But you know, down the road, this revenue source may not be needed for housing. It may be needed for water improvements or other. So for us, it's a frustration to have any preemption on how we use it or what the rates are, because each community is different. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you so much. We appreciate your testimony. Representative McLean, you're here for 3206?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2939 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3206. Chris, do you want to give us a short introduction to the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3206 increases the research and development tax credit from 5% to 8% of expenses for eligible business in a qualified county, and it also creates six different tax credits that pertain to businesses that operate in a qualified county. The bill does define the terms for that, but the six new credits pertain to purchases of, there's a 3% credit for hardware and software for businesses engaging in electronic commerce, a 12% credit for businesses that establish and implement an employee training program in collaboration with a community college. And then there are per credits, credits that are a certain amount per employee who is a graduate of the Oregon Institute of Technology, or that is hired by a new business, or that is hired into a insured position. And then there is also a 25% credit for rehabilitation costs for vacant properties that get rehabilitated for commercial purposes.
Bravo, lots of things. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming today. I know you're very busy, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you hearing this bill. My name is Mike McLean. I'm a state representative for Southern and Central Oregon, District 55, which includes Klamath County and everything north of that. I'm here with Werner Reschke, who represents District 56, and that is Klamath Falls and South Klamath County in over Lakeview. But bottom line is Representative Reschke and I represent all of Klamath County and most of Lake County. What we have here is an idea that was spawned by County Commissioner Kelly Minty Morris, who will be testifying here shortly, along with her from Klamath County, is the Economic Development Association Director Greg O'Sullivan, and the wing commander for Kingsley Field, the 173rd Fighter Wing, the Screaming Eagles, and that is Colonel Jeff Smith, better known as SLED to those of us who have served with him. But what we have is an opportunity for Klamath Falls and a way to lever the presence of a fighter wing, the 173rd Fighter Wing. There are some opportunities that Commissioner Morris will discuss, and Representative Reschke and I wanted to present this bill to you, not, of course, because it's perfect, nor because it's timely, given all the other issues going on with the state, but because it's needed. Klamath County has enjoyed a decline recently in its unemployment rate. We don't, in Klamath County, get to enjoy the prosperity of Portland. And we've had Geldwin sold and some other difficult things happen. But there is an opportunity with OIT there and a military base there to lever what is software type of projects that would not only have great appeal in a commercial sector in a world in need of cybersecurity, but would be an enormous boost to a county that has been challenged. And both the governor, because I listened to her inaugural address, and the Speaker of the House, because I listened to her inaugural address. And I didn't get a chance to hear Peter Courtney's. But I am confident to say that had I listened to it, that our presiding officers and the governor would be in agreement that anything they can do to help rural Oregon, they are willing to try. This has no impact on the environment. No one voting for this bill should be picketed by anyone from Water Watch or 1,000 Friends or anything like that. This does not impact the environment. We're not cutting a tree. We're not polluting a stream. We're not shooting a wolf. We're actually doing the things that people in, say, Representatives Nose District loves to do, and that is go to an office and code and get paid well for it. This is a tremendous opportunity where perhaps urban could meet rural, and we could provide in Klamath County some amazing jobs. Some OIT graduates could have some internships and be placed. So at the end, what you hear today is about an opportunity. It may not be completely certain. It may not be presented with, again, every T crossed and every dot I dotted, or every I dotted. But I would like to say in presenting this that this is an opportunity. It's something that Representative Reschke and I have fully supported. I admire greatly the chair of the county commission and her effort. Representative Minty Morris is a tireless worker and advocate for her county, and she has come up with something that has garnered wide support. And we would like to see this move forward to work session and moved in part of, if anything, that you would at least, Mr. Chair, factor that in there with your respective vice chairs in what could be a end of session package, which we could say, look, we did something for rural Oregon and brought the ability for our kids to stay in our communities and have great jobs. So that's why our motivation. I could go over the details. I just want to point out that some of these tax credits, they may seem a broad spectrum, but they're aimed to create attraction to a targeted audience. So when you talk about software purchases and hardware engagement, you know, X amount for certain training programs, you know, et cetera, it's aimed to attract a certain type of employer who is very interested in areas like Klamath County, where you have, think about it, OIT and the premier and only mid-level training base for F-15s in the United States. And now, Sled may come up and correct me, and I hope he doesn't, because I've been his JAG for years till recently. But I believe the Kingsley is not only one of the premier and, of course, has the best pilots in the world, but we are one of American NATO's mid-level training base for F-15s, which means we have amazing, talented people. It's a base that's going to be there. It's and so if you have an Air Force base, run by the Oregon Air National Guard, and you have OIT in the same location, you have opportunities that other communities don't have, and that's what we're trying to leverage. So with that, I've made my pitch, the details of which we can go through, but I'm going to defer to my the junior state rep from Klamath County for a comment.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and honorable members of the House Committee on Revenue, for the record, my name is E. Werner Reschke, State Representative, House District 56, which encompasses southern Klamath and Lake Counties. And before I begin, I want to thank you for letting me come down here. I've always wanted to know where all the revenue in Oregon was, and I keep looking around for the money and can't find it. So maybe you have it hidden under the desk there. I thank you and appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 3206, a bill which will help a struggling economy in southern central Oregon. While Klamath County is a phenomenal place to live and raise a family, with 300-plus days of sunshine each year and the natural outdoor beauty just minutes away, it requires a living wage job to be able to live there. According to testimony given by Chris Harder, Director of Oregon Business Development Department, on March 20 in front of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade, Oregon's unemployment rate at the end of 2016 was 4.3%, with 50,000 jobs added to Oregon's economy. Oregon's GDP growth topped the nation. However, Mr. Harder continued that while overall Oregon is doing well, it has been an uneven recovery. Rural Oregon faces continued challenges. Mr. Harder specifically picked Klamath County to show the contrast of rural struggles since the Great Recession. Quote, Klamath County remains about 9% below pre-recession employment levels. Let me read that again. Klamath County remains about 9% below pre-recession employment levels. The Oregon Employment Department predicts it, Klamath County, won't be out of the hole until 2024. In her inaugural address, Governor Kate Brown also highlighted the discrepancy between urban success and rural struggles. Quote, there is a disturbing gap between the unemployment rate in urban Oregon and rural Oregon. For families living in our rural counties, we must bust open the doors of opportunity so that individuals can find good-paying jobs right where they lived. She continued, to continue this and to ensure the economy is humming in every single corner of Oregon, we need to take a multifaceted approach, leveraging investments in workforce development, infrastructure, collaboration, and innovation. Colleagues, before you today, let me suggest is such a bill, a collaboration and innovation bill in HB 3206. So what does HB 3206 do? Here are some of the highlights. It creates multiple tax credits encouraging collaboration from the community college and military base and OIT. It tries to keep and retain people who graduate from the university to stay in the community. It encourages the rehabilitation of vacant rural buildings for commercial use, which we have, unfortunately, an abundant supply. And with that, I'm going to let the others from our county, led by Commissioner Kelly Minty Morris, further explain this bill and why it's worth your consideration.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have three others from the county to testify, but are there any questions for our colleagues?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And why don't the three of you come on up? Welcome. Welcome to your state capital. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Whatever order you want to present in would be fine. Just state your name and then give your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee for giving us this opportunity to work with you to bring new jobs and new investment to Oregon. I am Kelly Minty Morris, one of the Klamath County Commissioners, and I also sit on the Board of Trustees for the Oregon Institute of Technology, or Oregon Tech. So while many in the Capitol often talk about ducks versus beavers, I am firmly, unapologetically an owl. Because our graduates are so special, earning the highest average salary upon graduation, with a graduation placement rate of more than 90%, and with Oregon Tech routinely ranking as one of the best schools by various publications, we in leadership positions often ask ourselves, how can we encourage these talented graduates to stay in our great state, investing their talents in the future of Oregon? To help answer that question, I recently worked with three really brilliant students on their senior project. And full disclosure, when I say worked with them, they did all the work and I was supposed to supervise. They surveyed more than 600 of their peers to get a sense of why they leave our county and our state. And the results were really clear and maybe not surprising to everyone. But Oregon's best and brightest said they'd stay in Oregon and, importantly, in rural Klamath County if there were job opportunities. At that moment, I made a commitment to improve the job prospects in rural Oregon to prevent so-called brain drain and help lift up our economy. And that is when I began to work with Representative Mike McLean on House Bill 3206. When you review this bill, you may ask yourself, why would I support something that's so clearly just Klamath specific? But please consider this. All pockets and corners of our great state have unique attributes. Falls, beaches, in Representative Bueller's case, breweries, agriculture, and other ingredients that make up the special sauce of our state. For Klamath County, our unique attribute is the combination of Oregon Tech, the only polytechnic university in the Pacific Northwest, and Kingsley Air Base, the only F-15 fighter pilot training base in the country. We are uniquely positioned to contribute to the security and future job and, for your purposes, revenue creation of the state of Oregon by combining these attributes. While this bill will likely have a minimal impact on the state budget, the message it allows us to send is one of opportunity. Let's quit talking about the challenges of rural Oregon and instead talk about all the opportunities there. It is a priority of our governor, myself, Colonel Smith, and likely many of you to keep our citizens safe. We can help ensure the cybersecurity of our state and country well into the future by promoting these minimal credits for this growing industry. Consider this. South of us sits Silicon Valley. To the north of us is Seattle with Boeing and many other tech and aviation-related industry. What sits almost smack in the middle of the two is Klamath County. Today, you have an opportunity to reimagine the future of rural Oregon. You have the opportunity to promote new industry, new investment, new jobs, and hope. I ask your support of House Bill 3206. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I'm Colonel Jeff Smith, as has been stated before by my illustrious JAG. I am the commander of the 173rd Fighter Wing down in Klamath Falls at Kingsley Field. As a member of the executive branch agency, I am neutral on the House Bill 3206, but I was asked to provide testimony on Kingsley Field's economic impact to the Klamath County and how economic development can impact the continued success of the base. Kingsley Field employs over 1,050 personnel that include Air National Guard, Army National Guard, active duty, Title V civilians, Title 32 dual status technicians, state employees, and government contractors. These airmen, civilians, and contractors all work together for a common mission, and that is to produce America's F-15 C pilots. In 2010, after Tyndall Air Force Base, Florida, stopped training F-15 pilots and started training F-22 pilots, all of the nation's F-15 training shifted to Klamath Falls, Oregon. Since 2010, the Air Force has focused on increasing the pilot production overall, and F-15 pilot training requirements have increased as a result. To increase the pilot production, the active duty assigned about 90 families and airmen to the base and to Klamath County. And that started in 2014 as part of a Total Force Integration Active Association. This 20% full-time increase in personnel created an additional estimated 25 jobs in the local community and brought an extra $4.9 million per year into the local community as well. Overall, Kingsley Field yields approximately $81 million in financial impact for Oregon each year and remains one of the largest employers in Klamath County. As an Air National Guard unit, we have a mix of part-time and full-time military personnel. Our part-time citizen soldiers are absolutely instrumental to our operations. They allow us to meet global deployment requirements and stateside contingencies while we continue to do the in-garrison mission of training the F-15C pilots at home. These part-time members are essentially there to surge to war. They are also integrated throughout the community. They need jobs outside of our base, and they are currently employed in a wide range of both private and public positions. As such, recruiting and end strength really matter to us. The ability to meet the call of our in-garrison mission as well as the surge to war requires a large end strength and a high recruiting and retention number. And part of the recruiting and retention equation is having a large recruiting and retention base. And that comes with jobs. So having a larger economic basis around us, having more jobs available to the folks who are working part-time at the base that are also in the industry and of the skill level that are required for the base as well as the town are hugely important. We have a phenomenal working relationship with the elected officials in Klamath County, with the City of Klamath Falls, the Chamber of Commerce, and with CASITA, the Klamath County Economic Development Association. We routinely partner with OIT, Oregon Institute of Technology, and with Klamath Community College on programs that assist them and benefit them as well as benefit our airmen and the education of our airmen. These important relationships are part of what's called public-public, public-private efforts, more commonly known as P4. And have been recognized nationally. In 2013, the 173rd Fighter Wing was presented the Air National Guard Chief of Staff Team Excellence Award for collaboration with the city on runway repairs, local infrastructure upgrades, and the Community College of the Air Force programs. Continued cooperation, collaborative long-range planning, and open communication helps us to meet our mission. It helps to save precious taxpayer dollars and keeps us connected with the community within which we live and serve. I'm proud of our airmen, I'm proud of our civilians and contractors for their continued excellence in accomplishing our mission, and I'm glad that our presence and growth positively impacts the surrounding communities, and I thank you for allowing me to be here with you today.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Greg O'Sullivan, I'm with Economic Development, Klamath County. This bill is good for Klamath County, it's good for the state of Oregon. The landscape here shows that software and IT is one of the fastest growing industries in Oregon, with over 50% employment growth in the last 10 years. This bill looks to Klamath County to try to harness part of that and keep some of their brightest at home. Companies like Black & Veatch, Garmin, Symantec, Intel all utilize Oregon Tech graduates as part of their workforce. It is a great talent drain out of our community. We're happy to provide that talent to the state of Oregon. However, we all see that leakage also to the south of us, to places like the Silicon Valley. This bill brings together several very performing assets in Klamath County. It's already been mentioned about Kingsley Field. It's been mentioned about Oregon Tech. I don't know that we've underscored the Klamath Community College, which is just making a huge investment of about $3 million with the help of U.S. Department of Commerce monies to put in a technology and workforce center. At the same time, the private sector is extremely engaged in this particular strategy to keep more graduates at home, to bring in new cutting innovation into Klamath County, such as the property owners of Tech Hills, which is a 400-acre business park right next to Oregon Tech. So again, as we look to this bill, we look at Klamath County, we look at the state of Oregon, we say to ourselves, where will we retain the jobs in Oregon? It's going to be in rural places like Klamath County that come up with innovative solutions, innovative ways to attract companies. This particular bill gives us the ability to catch the notice of software companies and intelligent companies of tomorrow to take a look at a rural area. Each one of the tax credits and portions of this bill have been thoughtfully and carefully crafted to identify and to answer a specific issue or to capitalize on something in either Klamath County or in the business itself. Why would anybody want to renovate old buildings? When you think about a downtown area like Klamath Falls with older buildings, those are the exact buildings that startup and small companies like to go into. The new companies of tomorrow still like their connection to history, and the Gaucho Collective is one of those small facilities in the middle of Klamath Falls that provides shared office space for entrepreneurs. We have amazing new investment into Klamath County, some of which is from the state of Oregon through Connect Oregon grants to build new hangar space at our airport, some of which is small companies that are starting to expand, such as Carriage Works and others. We'd like to take a specific industry cluster such as the software and IT, and carve out our niche and possibly attract cybersecurity firms from all over the world to start with our best and innovative workforce, which is coming out of Klamath Community College, Oregon Tech. And even as of last week, we found out that the county schools has started an aeronautics and aviation program for middle through high school. So the career paths are there. The workforce is there. We just need to catch that notice of those companies that would consider a rural area like Klamath County. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, not sure what a JEG is. I looked it up in Google. And it's interesting because there's two definitions.
Oh, no.
There's one that's a legal definition that says someone who assists in court-martial administration. But there's also an urban definition.
Oh, no.
Of a mouthy person with no filter. Now, I'm going with the legal definition because I would never accuse my leader or my friend of the secondary definition. Now, with that said, and that is true under Google, but Mr. Chair, I want to raise a few thoughts here. Colleagues, I do economic development for a living, and I absolutely want to compliment the two representatives and the county commission, our military leader, for being here today. I think about this. This costs the state zero if they don't succeed. These are tax credits. On the other hand, if they do succeed, it's a minor investment that the state of Oregon will make in one of our most economically depressed communities. And I want to put a finer point on that. Business Oregon will spend millions of dollars to try and recruit, retain, incentivize economic development. And what you folks have created is a tool that does just that, but only affects the state if you're successful. And so I think you're onto something. As a person who does economic development, I have to tell you, I wish I would have thought about this. This is a great idea. I would hope that we could get past all the bipartisanship and everything that goes with these type of ideas and support this effort. I live in Heppner. We have our own economic challenges, but I would love to see us between now and 2024, I think was the sunset date on this, to take a shot at this and see if this makes sense and if it incentivizes economic development in one of our hardest hit communities. Representative, I think you did a great job on this, and I really think we ought to seriously consider this and see what happens and monitor it and watch it and see if it's a great tool that perhaps we could replicate in other parts of the state in a few years. Great job.
Thank you. As an expert in the area, it would be, I think the committee would welcome it if you were to look carefully at the bill and make certain that the sideboards are built in such a way that your prediction about costs turns out to be true.
Well, I would love to do that. You know, part of it's going to be based, Mr. Chair, on their success. And we'd have to take a look at that. But I think it would be advantageous for you to perhaps grab a couple of us to work with them and Business Oregon and to do kind of an economic impact statement to see what this potentially would mean to the state, both from a cost perspective, I get that, but also from a revenue generating opportunity for the state long term.
Right, and I did hear that second point, even though you didn't state it until just now. What I was thinking about was when we build a tax credit, when we get into trouble building a tax credit, it's because we didn't think of all the sideboards that are necessary in order to avoid leakage. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by leakage is somebody taking the tax credit who for activities that we didn't intend to incent and which, in fact, don't lead to a better economy or more opportunities for employment or better outcomes for the state. That's what I was thinking about. Representative Johnson had a different question. No? Are you finished? Okay. Anything else? Thank you so much. We very much appreciate an impressive testimony, and appreciate your taking the trip to come all the way to Salem. Mm-hmm. And with that, we'll close the public hearing. Which bill is this? On House Bill 3206, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2553.
Exactly. Not the obnoxious.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2553. We do have a dash one amendment to the introduced version. The introduced version of the bill requires or directs the Legislative Revenue Office to conduct a study on the relationship between cities and a substantial portion of their property that's under state agency or public university ownership, and the ability of those cities to apply for matching federal economic development grants. What the dash one would do is it would allow cities to apply for state matching grant fund program if at least 25% of the area of the real property in the city is exempt from property taxation under ORS 307090, which is the state and local government exemption and federal government exemption. But in this case, it'd be for if the property is exempt as property of the state or of a public university. To avoid repayment of the state grant funds, the city would be required to receive matching grant funds and use those funds to undertake an economic development or infrastructure project. It does establish a matching grant fund through the state, and it appropriates, or it leaves blank the appropriation from the general fund that would act as seed money for that Oregon City's matching grants fund program. It requires the Department of Administrative Services. They would receive the applications from the city and determine eligibility and disperse the funds. The grant funds are required to be no more than $50,000 per city or the amount requested by the city, the lesser of that amount, so it caps it at $50,000. And the Dash 1 amendment does repeal the grant program and the matching grant fund program July 1st, 2021 and July 1st, 2022. So it would be a temporary grant fund program that's put in place.
Okay, now, as originally written, this bill doesn't require a referral to Ways and Means, but I think the Dash 1 amendment would, wouldn't it? To fill in that blank about the general fund?
I believe that is true, Mr. Chair, yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And you've got less than 5 minutes' notice, Representative, but you're here.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Sorry, I was presenting another bill.
You're doing fine.
So, for the record, my name is Jody Hack. I represent House District 19, and I'm bringing before you House Bill 2553 with the Dash 1 amendment, which pretty much was a gut. Actually, it was a gut. Anyway, the intention of this bill is to allow four cities who have at least 25% of the area of real property in the city that's exempt from the ad valorem property taxation, so public properties, to have a $50,000 grant program put together for them that they can utilize, I'm out of breath, for matching grant applications. So often what happens is cities will apply for, have the opportunity to apply for grants for, say, infrastructure or economic development, and they have to come up with matching funds. Doesn't always mean it's the amount of the matching funds, but they may have to show some sort of buy-in or something to qualify for the grants. Representative Smith can probably speak to that. Myself as a grant writer, I can speak to that. I don't often write grants for cities. I usually write for schools, but anyway, what happens is cities who have a smaller tax base, because they have so many public buildings, don't have the large revenues that other cities do, so they're at a disadvantage. So what this does is it gives them an opportunity to be able to leverage some dollars to be able to apply for other grants, whether that be federal, state, local, whatever it is. And we've narrowed it down to infrastructure and economic development. I believe we're waiting to hear back, but I believe that there are the city of Salem, Corvallis, Monmouth, and they are looking at Eugene. Those would be the four that would qualify under this program. So that's what the grant does. We did put a sunset on it just to see who utilized it, if it actually worked. I know I've talked to my city, and they have some opportunity that they would gladly loved to take advantage of. Haven't had the opportunity to do that. But did put a sunset on it just to see if folks took advantage of it or not.
So that's what it is.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative Hay? Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I know that you are working on a lot of bills and doing a lot of hard work on them, so thank you.
Thanks.
For getting down here. Often when it's something this specific, there's like an opportunity that maybe your city has had that they weren't able to take advantage of for some reason. Did this come out of something like that, or is it more a kind of going forward, they have some ideas about specific things they could use this for?
I wouldn't say Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith-Warner. I wouldn't say there's anything absolutely specific. I think what sparked it for me was out in the city of Turner, we have city of Turner, Almsville, Salem that have been involved in a huge flood issue. And we had an opportunity to apply for a large federal grant, and all the cities had to come together with some matching funds in order for them to be able to qualify for some federal funds. And it was a significant amount of money to do an infrastructure study that was going to go all the way up the canyon and look at watersheds and some different things that would actually take care of a flooding issue that goes all the way up through Salem, actually into some of our state buildings. So that kind of sparked the conversation because they were having to come to the legislature for some matching funds. And so that's kind of what piqued my interest. But these funds, you know, probably wouldn't be able to be used for that. I know they wouldn't. But it just started the conversation, so we just started talking about the fact that oftentimes those things come about, and they don't have the ability to apply for them, and they come and they go. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where it started.
And if I may follow, thank you. And part of why I ask that is because that just 50,000 is not a large number in the grand scheme of things, although you are talking about a bit smaller cities, but Salem's pretty a significant size city. And I guess I was just thinking about whether that was going to, whether that would be sufficient, honestly, to mm-hmm. give them a match toward a reasonable, you know.
Mm-hmm. Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Smith-Warner, we did our research and checked, and typically what we looked at, it ranged anywhere from 50 to 75,000, sometimes upwards of 100. So in having conversations with the city, they said, you know, we can come up with part of this. We don't expect to have all of it, but if we could have some, that certainly would help us. And I think it's important for them to have buy-in too. So that's where we came up with the $50,000.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We have one other witness who wants to be heard today, and that's Wendy Johnson, League of Oregon Cities. You can stay right there if you want.
If you're good, I'm good, because I have the family leave bill going on the
other
side.
Oh, then you better go back to committee. Thank you.
Chair,
they looked at me like, what are you doing? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League, of course, supports House Bill 2553 with the -1 amendments. We just heard about it yesterday. It's focused on a small group of cities that have this large area that is tax exempt, those four cities. But it really points to the bigger problem that you all know of, which is our property tax system is just a mess. We would like that fixed. But any other tweaks along the way before we get that referral to the voters to really fix the system is much appreciated. I think the goal here is to try to leverage other dollars because every city is strapped, and so this allows a matching grant for these four cities, at least three: Salem, Corvallis, Monmouth, and we're still checking on Eugene. It's because the calculation is by area, not value, and that's just a different number that we're all not quite sure on how that will work out, which cities would be covered. But just to give you the big picture, $60 billion at least. We think it's actually higher than that because the assessors aren't assessing all the properties anymore since they're exempt, is off the tax rolls because it's owned by the public. And then the particular exemption that this bill is pulling out is 307-090. That's the state, city, county, school district, and special district ownership. So that's why it's hard to calculate. We have to calculate all of those entities. So we're not talking about the federally owned land. We're only talking about the state and the local government. So that 25%, the Department of Revenue runs those statistics each year. That is estimated to take $2.7 billion off the revenue roll. So not the value of the property, but that's how much is lost in revenue. And so it's a huge amount, especially for a community that has such a large portion that is owned by the public. So we support this bill because it does help those communities that have that nexus. You do. There's a letter from Nancy Brewer, from the finance director from Corvallis. Corvallis really struggles with this issue because they, as you heard in the previous bill today, they have an affordable housing problem. They have an urban growth boundary issue. They have a property tax issue. They're in compression, and there's just really nowhere, and there's really no other great revenue source. And so Nancy explains in there that they were applying for a park grant, but did not have the cash to make that grant. So she had an example right on the table of one that she could have leveraged. So it's a real issue there. Until we get Measure 5 relief, that community can't raise revenue in ways they would like to. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you so much.
You.
We appreciate your testimony. I'm sorry. There's some questions down here.
Well, Wendy, I think this is a bigger question than Measure 5, because this is Roy.
Marsh, please, go ahead.
Thank you. I didn't acknowledge. Thank you.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Because we're really talking about the property that we've set aside, and we've decided not to. We've called nonprofit, and that's a discussion that we've had up here to some degree. I mean, state properties are a different thing, but even if we were, that is an issue aside, it seems to me, from fundamental some of the other property tax issues that we struggle with. And I, as I look at this, I'm wondering two things. First, I'm wondering if the league has an analysis for cities across the state as to what percentage of ad valorem property taxation is exempt across the board, so we can sort of see what the averages are and where it falls, because I think that would be potentially helpful information. How significant is 25%? And then the second question I would have: if 25% really is an outlier, I wonder if we should have a broader conversation here, because with property tax being the major, it's close to only source of revenue for local government, that clearly impacts the community in many other ways.
Chair Barnett, Representative Marsh, wholeheartedly agree. The issue, area is one way to calculate it. Value is another, and that's the way that we usually look at it. So we could use information on both. But as you heard from the nonprofit bill with the hospitals earlier this session, we were hoping that work group would take a look at this and figure out, for the Corvallis situation, for example, part of Oregon State is used in the summer for other purposes, and that it never goes back on the tax roll. I mean, it is a revenue-generating item, the games that attract all the people, but there's no revenue coming back into the city. And if we're going to put that burden on cities, we have to give them some flexibility, and we just don't have it. So we were hoping for a pilot, some payment in lieu of tax type structure that many states are looking at to deal with nonprofits, particularly the larger revenue nonprofits, based on the value of their property, not necessarily the area is a new concept to me, but it's a complicated issue to deal with. The revenue shortage in each city, in each county, is unique because of either federal or the other exemptions or the nonprofit exemptions. So we're hoping to have that bigger conversation of all the exemptions, and you have a bill in this committee to look at some of those, but some of those aren't on the list either, that are going to just keep coming up, that each city is unique.
Well, in the meantime, if you have any data, I would love to. I think it'd be very interesting to see.
Representative Bueller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. Other data I'd like to see is, do we know the percent by area of real property in cities that are now designated as exempt from property tax for a variety of reasons, either nonprofit or other?
Great question.
I'd love to see that over the last 20 years.
Great question for Kyle.
Yeah.
And whether he has time for it or not, I don't know.
Too,
but
right?
Huh?
And we're trying to figure that out with the hospitals too.
It'd be any profit or any other exemption from property tax. I bet it'd be enlightening.
Yeah. Yes, Representative. That the work related directly to this bill is ongoing right now. Do you have a question now to the working with the county assessors to try to get information specific to this? But to the larger issue, yeah, that is what was discussed with some of the nonprofits as well. Is the tracking of the value isn't necessarily as good as the value of the property that's actually on the roll. So the value of, say, the Capitol building, there might be a number on there because there has to be a number put on there by the assessor, but it gives some sense of the value of the property that's exempt, but it may not be as, I guess, realistic in some cases.
As long as it's I'm not so interested in the value, but the trend over the last two decades. So as long as we're using the standard methodology, that's not so much a concern of mine.
Yep, I think I get the point you're driving at. If the numbers are going up as a percentage of the total real property, then that would be an area of major concern.
Yeah, I suspect it has.
Representative Marsh?
Well, I just wonder how it could not have, since we are constantly putting property tax credits out there for people to take advantage of.
Yeah.
We're growing markedly our nonprofit sector.
Right. Various exemptions, right. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2553 and adjourn the committee until tomorrow.